Are you familiar with the smartphone app called Flappy Bird? I know some of you probably are. Some of you have it on your phone right now, probably. Flappy Bird is a very simple side-scroller game for smartphones that features an odd little bird character. And the object of the game is to flap the bird safely through an obstacle course that becomes increasingly difficult as you go along. It's a simple game in concept, but difficult to master. In fact, if you've ever played it, you know how frustrating that game can be very quickly. Well, the game was initially released in May of 2013 and was largely ignored at the time. But then suddenly, in early 2014, it shot up in popularity. In fact, it became the most downloaded free game in the iPhone and Android app stores by the end of January 2014. By early February, the game had been downloaded a total of 50 million times. The game was free, but it featured in-app advertising. During its peak of popularity, the app was earning its developer $50,000 a day from in-app advertising. Not bad for 3 days of programming. That's how long it took him to make the game. Then, unexpectedly and abruptly, the developer, he pulled the game off the market, removing it from all of the app stores. The game was no longer available for download. For those of you who might not understand how this kind of thing works, if you had already downloaded the game onto your phone, it was still yours, and it was still there, but no new people were able to get the game. Well, people had a fit over the disappearance of this silly little game. And as you might imagine, within days, a number of enterprising individuals were selling their used smartphones with Flappy Bird installed on them on eBay. At the height of Flappy Bird fever, one guy was selling his used iPhone 5S with Flappy Bird for a whopping $100,000. I've heard that eBay prevented the sale from going through for legal reasons, but it gives you a sense for the value that some people were putting on this free game at one time back in February of 2014. You can get the game anywhere and everywhere now for nothing. People can have very different ideas about the value of things. In the stories we'll be looking at today, we're going to see a stark contrast between the way two people value things. Specifically, one of these people will see Jesus as priceless. The other person will sell him out for little more than pocket change. So let's flip over to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, and we're continuing our study through that book. Mark chapter 14, and we'll begin in verse 1. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people." It's now Wednesday of the final week of Jesus' life, what has come to be referred to as the Passion Week. The Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread that's referred to here was actually two Jewish festivals that are observed back to back. Passover was observed on the 14th day of the month of Nisan. Then the Feast of Unleavened Bread is celebrated for the next 7 days following. Because these two festivals are observed together, they're treated as a single event, commemorating God delivering the Israelites from Egyptian slavery. This was one of the annual pilgrim feasts observed by the Jews, which meant people from all over have traveled to the city of Jerusalem to participate in it. The population of the city swelled by several times during these festivals. The religious leaders have been looking for a way to get rid of Jesus. But they have to be very careful about how they go about it. Jesus is still very popular with the common people, and the city is stretched to capacity with out-of-towners who have come to Jerusalem for the festival. The chief priests and scribes feel it would be too risky to try to arrest and kill Jesus during the festival. They're going to wait. The crowds could easily become excited and then riot, and then that would make the Romans unhappy, which is something that everyone wanted to avoid at all cost. However, the unexpected help offered to them by one of Jesus' own disciples will change their plans, as we'll see when we get back down to verse 10. But the scene changes now from these dark seats of power in the city of Jerusalem to the small town of Bethany, about 2 miles east of Jerusalem, situated on the other side of the Mount of Olives. Verse 3. And while he was in while he was at Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. Jesus and his disciples are in the home of a man named Simon the leper. Now, we don't know how Simon got this name. Some believe he once had leprosy, but Jesus had healed him, perhaps. Now, just between you and me, I don't think I would like that nickname no matter how I acquired it. I don't want to be called the leper. Well, as he was reclining at table, it says here, people in that culture, they didn't sit in chairs around a table while they eat like we commonly do. Instead, they reclined around the table, leaning on cushions with one arm and eating with the other, and their feet pointing out away from the table. Well, while Jesus and the other people are reclining around the table eating, a woman takes a bottle of very expensive perfume and she pours it on Jesus' head and feet. Mark doesn't say who this woman is, but John's gospel tells us it's Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. John chapter 12 tells this story. John's account of the story also tells us that Mary used her hair to wipe Jesus' feet as she pours the perfume on them. We learn in verse 5 that this bottle of perfume was worth 300 denarii. A denarius was what a common worker was paid for a day's worth of work. So 300 denarii would be more than what a common man made in a year. Now think about your own life for a moment to put this in perspective. The amount of money you make in a year's time employed full time is less than what this perfume was valued at. It cost many thousands of dollars. See, this is not Old Spice aftershave being splashed around on Jesus' feet or some imitation French fragrance that you would buy at Walmart. This is some of the finest perfume that money could buy. Expensive bottles of perfume like this were used as long-term investments in those days. These bottles of perfume were very rare and maintained their value over time. And because they were relatively small in size, they were easy to store and keep hidden. All features and qualities that you would want in an investment in those days. This perfume, it may have been Mary's life savings, her retirement fund, her nest egg, a family heirloom, a large inheritance. And what does Mary do with this very expensive perfume, with her life savings? She doesn't dab a little of it here and there on Jesus' feet. She doesn't put a little behind his ear. She pours the entire bottle out on his head and his feet, as if it were little more than ordinary water. The house is filled with its fragrance. This was a beautiful expression of Mary's love and worship for Jesus. She's giving him what is most likely the most valuable material thing she owns. Not everyone appreciates what she has done, though. In verse 4, it says, "There were some who said to themselves indignantly, 'Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor.' And they scolded her." So some of those present were outraged at the gross waste. "That perfume could have been sold and the money used to feed the poor. What are you doing?" Well, on the surface, this sounds like a very legitimate criticism. One of the traditions associated with the Feast of Unleavened Bread and Passover was to show generosity to the poor during this time. Mark doesn't identify who it was that's complaining about the waste of the perfume, but we learn from both Matthew's account and John's account of this same incident that some of the people complaining were the very disciples of Jesus. And in particular, the loudest complainer was Judas Iscariot, the disciple who will betray Jesus. It says they scolded her. Have you ever noticed how godly and generous people can be with other people's money? I mean, it happens all the time, doesn't it? Whose perfume is this? It's Mary's. Who had any say over what was done with that perfume? Mary. It's usually, by my observation, the people who are the stingiest with their own money who are the quickest to volunteer other people's money to be donated for the cause. Have you ever noticed that? And it's usually the stingiest people who are constantly judging others about how they are using their money and time and so forth. It brings to mind Titus 1:15, where Paul wrote, "To the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled." See, our judgmental attitude, it reveals the true nature of our own heart. What appears to be a heartfelt concern for the poor being expressed by Judas and others is really hypocrisy, veiled stinginess, and spiritual blindness. See, if they want to do something for the poor, then they should do something for the poor. It's unfortunate they fail to appreciate this beautiful expression of worship by Mary, and they fail to recognize the significance of these last moments they have with Jesus. Jesus is going to die for their sins in less than 2 days. Verse 6, "But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's done a beautiful thing to me.' So Jesus, he immediately comes to Mary's defense. He tells them they should be commending her for her actions rather than condemning her. What they call a waste, Jesus calls a beautiful thing. Very different value system. We can be so out of step with Jesus about what's important in a particular moment. I mean, I'm ashamed to say how many times I have felt so clearly right about something and learned later how foolish and wrong I was. Why is this perfume being wasted? It could have been used to feed the poor. And the voice of the Lord speaks to my heart later, 'Leave her alone, Jeff. She's done a beautiful thing to me.' I get knocked off of my high horse and I see things from his perspective and I realize what a hypocritical, self-righteous fool I've been. Verse 7. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. Jesus tells them that they'll have other opportunities to help the poor, but he will not always be with them. He will not be with them much longer. In less than 2 days, he's going to be put on trial, condemned, and nailed to a wooden cross to die. Now, just to clarify, Jesus is not implying in any way that we should not be concerned about the poor. The Bible is full of teaching about the importance of helping the poor. Jesus teaches on the importance of helping the poor. In addition to this act of Mary's being an expression of her love and worship of Jesus, he says it's also a preparation of his body for his burial. Mary was always a good listener to Jesus. You might remember the story in Luke 10:38, when her sister Martha was busy taking care of all the guests, and she complains to Jesus about Mary not helping her, because Mary was sitting at the feet of Jesus listening to him teach. See, Mary was a good listener. She paid careful attention to what he said and taught. She was one of his very best students, and one of the most spiritually in tune and insightful of his followers. I actually believe she's one of the few people at this moment, if not the only one, who actually knew in her heart that Jesus would only be with them a short time more. One of the difficult things about someone dying who we care a great deal about is not having the opportunity to tell them all the things that we wish we had before they die. Mary is expressing those things to Jesus right now while she still has the opportunity. Verse 9, he finishes by saying, "And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." So Jesus says that this story of Mary's act of love would be remembered and told wherever the gospel is preached. And we are witnesses of the fulfillment of Jesus' words today, because we're talking about it right now. Now, one last thing about this before we move to the next story. In the story about the poor widow in Mark chapter 12 that we looked at a few weeks ago, who put the two tiny coins into the temple offering, the people watching her, they scoffed and they sneered, saying it was a useless, meaningless gift. What are two little copper coins going to be good for? They're worth nothing. In this story about Mary pouring this very expensive perfume on the head and the feet of Jesus, those watching, they criticize and they complain that it's a foolish, gross waste. The poor widow had given the Lord all that she had to live on. Mary gave the Lord the most valuable thing she owned. Jesus praises both of these women for their sincere devotion and love. They didn't concern themselves with the risk or the cost involved. They simply loved the Lord with all their heart. Ultimately, Jesus doesn't look at the human wisdom or practicality or ingenuity of our acts. Instead, he looks at the sincere love for him that's prompted and expressed through that love we have, no matter how small or great the act may appear to be. You remember Jesus said the greatest command is this: love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. We can't find a more powerful example of that than these two women. Verse 10 says, then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray him. So the scene shifts to Judas. These verses, they're connected with verses 1 and 2 above that we read a moment ago. The chief priests and the scribes, they've been looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus with the intent to have him killed. Judas now provides them the opportunity they've been looking for. And it causes them to change their mind about the timing of their plans. They're not going to wait until after the Passover feast to make their move now. Judas, he was an insider, able to tip them off about where Jesus would be when he would be alone away from the crowds. He could help them find Jesus quickly and quietly when no one else is around and then sweep him off. They agree to give Judas a certain sum of money for betraying Jesus. Mark doesn't tell us how much that money was, but we learn from Matthew's gospel that it was a measly 30 pieces of silver, about 12 ounces. At current silver prices, that would be about $200. The question that's often asked is, why did Judas agree to do this? Why did Judas betray Jesus? I mean, of all of the people that would inspire the undying loyalty of his followers, it would be Jesus, right? So why would one of those closest to him choose to betray him? First, make no mistake about it, Judas made his own choice to betray Jesus. He was not some kind of robot being swept along by the prophecy that must be fulfilled or being controlled by Satan to act against his own will. Judas was responsible for his actions, regardless of the fact that those actions corresponded with the will of prophecy and of Satan. See, Satan can only draw out of us what's already there. James 1:13, a familiar passage for many of you. He says, let no one say when he's tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil. And he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Well, did Judas betray Jesus for the money? I mean, if he did, he sold out for pretty cheap, and he's really kind of stupid. I mean, I'm certain he could have gotten more than 200 bucks for Jesus. Especially considering how badly these guys wanted Jesus. Was Judas in league with one of the radical political groups wanting to overthrow the Romans, and he thought that somehow this would force Jesus' hand and cause him to make his move to establish his kingdom, overthrow the Romans, start the war? You remember, most people in Israel at the time were looking for a Messiah that was going to be a great Davidic king that would establish them as a power overthrowing their enemies. We don't know what motivated Judas to do what he did. I mean, we don't always know what motivates ourselves to do what we do. What we do know is this, that God took what was intended for evil and brought good out of it. God's sovereign will is being realized even through the sin and evil of men bent on the killing of his son. Luke chapter 22, verse 3, and John 13, 27 say that Satan entered into Judas. Ultimately, this conflict is not just between the Jewish religious leaders and Jesus over some ideological differences. Beneath the surface, this conflict is cosmic in scope. It's a war between God and all that is good versus Satan and the devils of hell and all who are imprisoned by their influence. The battles that we witness in the physical realm are only a part of the larger war taking place in the spiritual realm. Satan wants to destroy Jesus. He is working with and through the religious leaders and Judas to carry out his assault on Jesus. Satan knows that Jesus is the Son of God. He knows that Jesus has come to destroy his work if Jesus is allowed to continue. What Satan doesn't realize is that by killing Jesus, he will be sealing his own fate and ultimate defeat and helping to secure the salvation of humanity. He will have played into the hands of the Lord. In closing, there's a big difference in the value that Mary and Judas each place on the life of Jesus. Mary gave the most valuable thing she had to Jesus as an act of love and worship. Judas sold Jesus out for a couple hundred bucks. What value do you and I put on Jesus and his kingdom? I mean, that's the question. I'm reminded of two parables Jesus told in Matthew chapter 13. The first is Matthew 13, verse 44. Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field." The second parable immediately follows in verse 45. Jesus said, "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who, on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it." One of the things that distinguish the best treasure hunters from the crowd is their ability to recognize the true value of something. When you see Jesus, do you see a worthless glass bead or do you see a priceless pearl? When you see Jesus, do you see an empty field of dirt or do you see a hidden treasure worth more than all you have? It takes spiritual discernment to see the true value. 1 Corinthians 1, 21. I'm reading from the New Living Translation on this. "Since God in his wisdom saw to it that the world would never know him through human wisdom, he's used our foolish preaching to save those who believe. It's foolish to the Jews who ask for signs from heaven, and it is foolish to the Greeks who seek human wisdom. So when we preach that Christ was crucified, the Jews are offended and the Gentiles say it's all nonsense. But to those called by God to salvation, both Jews and Gentiles, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God." Let's bow our heads. Father, I pray for every single one of us in this room today that you would enable us to see the true value of Jesus Christ. That his value is beyond compare. That to know Christ is worth everything. To follow him leads to true life. I ask you to encourage your people this morning, Lord, that you would ignite our hearts and love for you, Lord, in a fresh new way today as we reflect on our Jesus and his value to us. Make that so, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.